You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
We were driving along and we saw a drug deal go down. It was a college kid selling to another college kid. We pull over and we ask him, "What's in your pocket?" And he's like, nothing in my pocket. "Do you mind if I search you?" "No, you can't search me." "Do you mind if I search you?" Okay, this is the police. I'm just documenting this. "Can I search you?" "No, I can't search you."
Has the acid hit yet?
So, no, he was the dealer.
I'm saying for you. Like, how crazy would that be?
Oh, God, could you imagine? So, what this guy in his head thought was that if I pee in my pants, they're not going to search my pockets. So right there on camera, he peed in his pants.
It's not suspicious at all.
No, not suspicious at all. So you know what the cop did? Put on a rubber glove.
Hey, welcome to another episode of 2020. My name is Corey Peza, here as always with Siobhan Cronin and Benny Goodman. How are you guys doing?
How are you doing, Corey?
Man, I'm
all good.
Yeah, doing great. We got a great episode today. Very cool. An old friend of Ben's who happens to be actually genuinely interesting. Paul Haber.
I thought it was even more impressive that he was real.
Yeah.
Most of my friends are fictitious.
This guy, Paul Haber, he's an investigative journalist up in Canada.
This guy.
And absolutely fascinating career. And just a wealth of information, really.
Yeah, no, he had so many stories lots of different experiences across the whole spectrum of journalism, TV, news, cop type shows. I mean, just about every facet that you can think of in terms of TV.
And only to perpetuate the Canadian ideal, he is very, very, very thoughtful, seems to be very non-biased and deep thinking. Who would have thought? And he speaks slowly and clearly.
Yeah, he definitely stood out on this show. but check him out. This episode it's great. Learn some of the behind the scenes stuff on how your favorite like news networks and production stuff works. Check it out, Paul Haber, part one.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of 2020. Where we may be socially distant, but still socially relevant. I say that because who knows? We could be on lockdown by the time this is airing again. Like, it could be totally fine. Who knows? My name is Benny Goodman. I'm here with my cohorts in this debauchery. First and foremost, my lady friend and excellent virtuoso violinist. Also next door to a guy producing hip hop at this exact moment in time. Siobhan Cronin.
Oh, Ben, that was such a nice intro today. The last few, you've been like not so wordy. So that was nice. Thank you.
Not so wordy. I thought that was nice. You're giving me mixed signals here.
Yeah, the less words,
depends
the
on the mood. Yeah.
And then the voice that you just heard, the lovely baritone, is Corey Peza.
Thank you, Ben.
What a nice tee-hee. And I'm so excited. I've known this guy since 1994. I know. It's crazy. I've known him. He was my camp counselor at a Jewish overnight camp in New Hampshire. And and we've both grown to be very different, trees, if you will. But he's my Canadian friend who is a ridiculous world-class skier. He's a daredevil that you can like strap things to him and he'll hang from a plane or a helicopter. He is a unbelievable director of photography, of shows, producer. He's kind of a man of a lot of different things. He's one of those dudes that's kind of like manifested everything he likes and then just kind of gets paid to do it. So we're going to find out exactly what that is. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for my Canadian friend from up above, Paul Haber.
Hello. Thank you.
Woo.
Super excited to be here. Thank you. As Benny just said, we go back a long time, and you know, as we don't see each other much, but we keep in touch, luckily, because of social media, stuff like that, and you know, like the bond's still there.
That's the best way to keep a bond with Ben, is just not to see him very much.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Ben doesn't really let go of the bond ever, so it's kind of hard to shake him off, I'm sure.
You know the joke, right? Like, what's the difference between a pit bull and a Jewish mom?
No, what is it?
A pit bull eventually lets go.
Are you calling yourself a Jewish mother?
Like, we have a camaraderie that, like, you know, like, it's like the seeing the metalhead amongst all the Dave Matthews Band guys, like seeing like the one guy with the Megadeth shirt, like looking all confused and is black, and everyone else is all like Abercrombie'd out. You're like, oh, it's the same thing. Like,
you stand out, but you fit in.
You fit in, like with the other weirdos.
Exactly. So yeah, and you know, I ended up at that place by fluke. Really, is, you know, I was looking for a job. I needed more pay than they could pay me in Canada because I had to pay for university. So what better? Go to the US where, boom, you get an instant 30% bump on your dollar. So I ended up in New Hampshire.
At that time.
Yeah, at that time.
It wasn't so loony back then.
It wasn't so loony. So, you know, it was a complete fluke that I ended up at that camp. They were looking for somebody. I was looking for something to do. And Bob's your uncle. I ended up there. So... Yeah, that's going back to my university days where I was on waterfront staff. I was a swim instructor. I taught water skiing. Those were the best days ever.
It was literally like one of those crazy, it was like a summer movie. It's like, I learned how to water ski there. It was like elitist Jewish camp, you know, where we like had, it was very nice. It was very, very nice. But
the people weren't like that. The people weren't,
but I'm just saying by comparison to like what a lot of people are privy to, this was totally like white picket fence.
Yeah,
beautiful summers.
My summer camp was like dodgeball and like a splintery swing set at the local like elementary school. So we were lacking in that the water skiing department and all that.
Siobhan, where
stuff.
Did you vacation?
Where did I vacation? I really didn't vacation much growing up, but yeah. I did go to summer camp, but it was probably somewhere in between your version of summer camp and Corey's version of summer camp. It was like free spirit artsy summer camp where you did like pottery and then like went swimming and did stuff like that.
But it's all the same. It's all relatively, you meet people and, you know, sometimes you make bonds for the rest of your life. Some of my closest friends are camp friends. So,
wow, that's great.
To me, camp was one of the most important influential times in my life. And being a counselor, being an instructor, a counselor, I like hoped as a young, dumb kid, I hope to like instill some of that onto the kids that I live with. So.
And the weird part was that you had like a group of people, like our buddy Hillel, and there's like a whole group of people, Josh Marmer, and you guys, like, it's funny because like I've gone and done like all these artistic things, but like I feel like the catalyst to a lot of that was going away and having a bunch of guys going, dude, you gotta listen to Jerry Garcia. And I'm like, I don't get it. And then, you know, one guy's going, listen to Van Halen. I'm like, okay, I get that. But then, you know, you guys are telling me about life and all this stuff. And I was so grown up in a bubble, like in a very, you know, upper middle class Jewish neighborhood where like everything was fine and everyone waved at each other. Like, so I didn't know the world at all. And, you know, this whole like outside, like meeting older dudes that were like, yeah, man, you can go and party and hang out with Jerry. And it was like one of the first, actually, it was the reason I bought tickets to the first concert I ever bought tickets to, which was the Grateful Dead with Bob Dylan in Vermont in 1995. And it was one of the first concerts.
Dylan and the Dead.
Yeah. And ironically, it was one of like the 10 concerts that like Jerry ended up having to cancel because he died. So. Mm-hmm. I never went.
Way to start it off on a positive note.
I missed it. Sorry, guys. I literally missed the Dead by that much.
So that,
all right,
that's,
well, Ben,
going,
enough
that's
about
way
you.
Back. That's going way back. So now, you know, let's jump to the present, you know, and there's a whole bit of meat in the sandwich. Now I'm an investigative journalist. Ooh. And the show is like a Canadian, it's, believe it or not, like 2020, Dateline. It's that type of show. And our show existed before those shows existed. So
in Canada?
In Canada, exactly. So we're in our 55th season right now. I haven't been there
for 55
years.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
How many years? Do you guys follow the same calendar system as us here?
We do. And our season goes from September to April.
So 55 seasons? Is that like in Survivor seasons or is that in like real year seasons?
That's real year seasons.
Oh shit.
We have a September to April run once a year. We go, we do it. And it's pretty much, you know, for the most part, we look to find bad people. We look to bring important issues to light. We look to...
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, I'll tell you what I'm doing right now. That's one more day of editing and then airs next week is video game addiction.
So, oh, yeah. Well,
video game, but there's different levels. There's and it's growing because of the pandemic. Like there is
extreme imagine.
Levels.
Yeah, like my husband started here and now he's about here.
Right. But there's a lot of people who just can't stop. And when they do stop, they become so depressed that suicide pops into their mind, or, you know, it destroys their schooling. It destroys their relationships where they absolutely have nothing. Some people stop eating. Some people stop showering. Some people just cannot get unfixated from a game. And that's an issue.
Yeah. So investigative journalism is it's a pretty intense field. Like, let's take it back. What led you into that world?
So what led me to that is actually... Let's rewind like way, way back.
Yeah.
I'm a biologist, believe it or not.
Say, your biology degree was completely in use.
So I studied biology and my ultimate goal was to go into medicine. I wanted to be a doctor. And then come university, you know, I finished my undergraduate degree and I'm like, I cannot handle another 10 years of school. That's just, it's just not for me. Mm-hmm. So somebody offered me a job right out of school in television production, you know, as the pretty much the assistant floor sweeper. I swept floors and learned a tremendous amount and like eventually became an assistant to the producer, which, you know, was a glorified coffee boy and just like slowly but surely started chugging my way along. And I applied for a job at Discovery Channel and I landed it and I started there. That's where like it really took off from there. Making documentaries.
So when you got that first job, did you, like, how long did you stick around and wonder, like, is this something I actually want to do? Like, at what point did you realize that you did actually want to pursue that as an interest? Because obviously you're coming right out of school, thinking about being a doctor. You end up at a job that's sort of like bottom level. You know, I feel like I would just get burned out. So I would get burned out so quickly and be like, there's so many levels between here and where I want to be, you know? So it's interesting. You know,
yeah. And to tell you the truth is, even though I was at the bottom level, I saw the potential and I realized like how much fun people have. Yes, we work like 14 to 16 hours some days.
Yeah.
But we're having a good time doing it. Yes, we're exhausted, but we always manage to have a drink after work. We always manage to be able to, you know.
Alcoholism. It's one thing you can count on.
Yes, especially as a Canadian. I'm gonna have my first one now, if that's okay.
Oh, please, no, go for it. I've been drinking
it on this show. All right.
And this is a beer I brought back from Quebec over Christmas break.
Is it a poutine beer?
It is not a poutine beer. That would be.
I'm not sure how I feel about that. Yes. I think poutine and beer should be separated.
Yes.
I mean, I don't. I think there's a lot of people that think that cheers, mayo guys. And anything to do with like, cheers, dude. With fries should be separated, but like, you know, there are heathens out there.
For the, you know, when you started in the television area,
yeah,
what aspect of it caught you the most? Like, was it production stuff or the actual journalism aspect or, you know, what drew you in?
You know what? It's probably the same as music. And I'm just taking a stab here. You know, you have a tight group of people where your creative energy is all put into one place. You're working hard to get to a certain level. There's a lot of obstacles. There's a lot of ups. There's a lot of downs. But you all work together to make it happen, to make something sound beautiful. Same as in television, you know, like we're all sort of have the same goal of we have obstacles. We have troubles. We have problems. We work together. We work long hours and we put out a product that we all feel proud of. And at the end, it's that product that's like, makes me happy and makes you want to go back and keep doing it. And you want to get better every time. So correct me if I'm wrong. Is that the same in music?
Absolutely. I think any career or job or project where you have something to show for your work at the end of it is, I think, the best job in the world. Like where you, cause you know, I worked a 9-to-5. I actually worked in radio for 10 years and I basically aside from doing some talk show stuff, I kind of get sucked into the more corporate side, and I would get out of work, and the next morning I'd go in and there'd be the same pile of work to do. I'd get out of work that day, the next morning there'd be the same pile, and there was nothing, nothing to build upon. So I think with music and television, especially like investigative journalism, where you're actually going to, you're kind of going after a goal and producing something that then you get to present to the world, there's a huge sense of accomplishment with that, right?
Absolutely. It lives forever, which is, you know, somebody 1,000 years from now could see something.
But I think you're missing something. At least maybe it's different in Canada, because a lot of the people I've met in Canada are all very even keeled, and you guys are all like chill and relaxed out there. But like talking to someone like Drewanne Rosenberg, who's a big time AD out in California, it sounds like the director has a different view than the producer has a different view than the actor. And it's a constant level of discourse, and that, you know, because art is subjective, like three people may have three different views, which is why you have like these different directors' cuts and, you know, this guy didn't like working with that guy or, but, and it seems to me like your story functions under the assumption that everyone's getting along going hee, and everyone looks at the final vision and it's great. Like, is there any kickback? Like, is there a producer?
Absolutely. Oh yeah, absolutely. There's kickback, but you know, I've been lucky that there's been mutual respect with everybody. And, you know, you take everybody's consideration, you listen to what they have to say. Sometimes you have to a little arm wrestle, but it really, you know, ultimately comes down to one final person. But I try and listen to everything that everybody says, you know, from
isn't it ultimately just usually like a shootout, like a good old fashioned hockey shootout. Like, isn't that what you do in Canada?
It could be. It definitely could be. Yeah.
Put on your mask.
Yeah. Put on your mask and take a slap shot and hope you don't lose any teeth.
You got your jersey back there and you're ready to go.
You got it. I know.
So let me ask you.
My jersey, my exercise bike.
I know. We saw that when we first got on. Very cool. So what was your first kind of stab at doing something creative in the job that you had? Because like you said, you sort of started at the entry level doing stuff that probably wasn't related to any production. So what was kind of your first step into actually getting to do something that excited you in that realm?
Yeah, that's a very good question. You know, I would say from day one, there was always like a little tapping of creative energy here and there. It's like, oh, do you have, what could we do here? What could we do there? Mm-hmm. That type of thing. But it really started to click for me is when, you know, I started off, my first job was in, it's like a talking head show. It was more like a PBS news type show, where I got to the level where it's like, you could go find your own guest to talk about this topic and, you know, bring in somebody who you feel would be good at explaining this. So like talking about it, like if I make a phone call to a U.S. senator, because it was a Canadian-U.S. It was a Canadian-U.S. relations show. Slightly boring, in my opinion, but, you know, people loved it. So when I was able to get the people that I wanted on and hear their opinions, that's when it really started clicking for me. And then from there, the jumping off point was I got really sick of that job and I wanted to melt my science with TV, and Discovery Channel was like the perfect match. And I was there for a while, you know, doing all kinds of documentaries from technology to animals to elephants.
Give us an example of like some documentaries that you've done with Discovery Channel that maybe us stoners who watch everything that's on the Discovery Channel have watched. So we can be like, yo, that's Paul. That's Paul, man.
So I'm not sure. I think they aired in the US. I'm not sure. But again, this is going back a bit. So one of the most fun projects I did was behind the scenes of things, the inside out. And it was actually called Inside Out. So, you know, we took an event, say New Year's Eve in Times Square, and we did a deep dive on behind the scenes of Times Square. So deep that we went to Ireland where they make the crystals, the Waterford crystals, and those are the things that go on the ball. Hundreds of those Waterford crystals go on the ball. Jeez. And, you know, it's not just crystal because they have to survive super high heat on the inside and super cold on the outside. So it was like going to that factory in Ireland, seeing how they make those, everything from the FBI sealing manhole covers, snipers on the roof. We got to experience all that. And on New Year's Eve, when it was showtime for us to like put it all together, You know, I was able to be there and experience it with Cyndi Lauper. It was kind of fun.
Oh my gosh.
So wait, this New Year's?
No, this is I would say this is probably
just because I was gonna say I saw her this New Year's and that wasn't fun for me.
No, this is probably like
I felt terrified actually.
This is probably going back 15 years or so.
Didn't you tell me one time, like, I remember getting a call, you telling me when we met up in person that, like, you were, like, shooting something and you were in a helicopter crash. Was that for Discovery?
So that was after Discovery.
Okay, I was going to say, how are you omitting this right now?
Yeah, that's a little bit further down the line. And that was a crazy experience in my life.
Like, what the fuck?
So from Discovery, I left Discovery, you know, just, it was time to move on. I think I was there for about 10 years, time to move on. And I went into the reality genre. So a little bit of reality TV.
Doesn't you know, a few of those people.
Yeah. And this show, which definitely does air in the US and did well, was called Campus PD.
Where
it was sort of it was cops for college kids. So I did a couple of seasons of that.
That seems like very weird considering like I feel like you're the last dude to be like, dude, you have weed in your room. You're out of school. You're losing your scholarship. Like,
I felt so bad for some of these kids.
I just say, I can imagine the empathy.
That was me.
That was you, man. You're totally like listening to the dead smoking weed. And now you're narking on those fuckers with a camera.
But here's the thing is I wasn't dumb enough to do some of the things that these people did. Like I wouldn't go smoke a joint in the middle of the street, taking a construction cone, putting it on my head, and trying to direct traffic.
Yeah.
So I've done it a few times. Yeah. I've never been arrested for that.
So those are the people that we, you know, sometimes nabbed. Here's a great little anecdote on this. And one of the best busts we did, and I felt so bad for this guy, but he pulled such a maneuver. We were driving along and we saw a drug deal go down. It was a college kid selling to another college kid. We pull over and we ask him, what's in your pocket? And he's like, nothing in my pocket. Do you mind if I search you? No, you can't search me. Do you mind if I search you? Okay, this is the police. I'm just documenting this. Can I search you? No, I can't search you.
Has the acid hit yet?
So, no, he was the dealer.
I'm saying for you. Like, how crazy would that be?
Oh, God, could you imagine? So, what this guy in his head thought was that if I pee in my pants, they're not going to search my pockets. So, right there on camera, he peed in his pants.
It's not suspicious at all.
No, not suspicious at all. So, you know what the cop did? Put on a rubber glove.
Well, anyone that's ever watched Discovery knows that you can drink your pee because it's sterile.
Yeah.
So technically, at the end of the day, there's worse things you could touch
on a show like that,
like spiders. Yes.
You know, I think about this. You know, when I used to watch Cops and in a similar genre, how does the production look on that? Like, is it just driving around hoping to get lucky, going through you know tapes and tapes and tapes until you get that one good scenario?
That is exactly what it is, and honestly, on that show, there was nothing faked. It was 100% real. It was myself, two camera, and an audio. So it was a crew of four people and a production assistant. What we did was...
Was this your brainchild?
No, it definitely was not my brainchild. This was a paycheck.
Where would you get your leads? Like, how would you know that this person is probably a drug dealer and we need to follow them? Like, how does
that
work?
So we pretty much were embedded with a police department for a month straight. We would work Wednesday to Sunday, every night from 8 p.m. to 4 a.m., 5 a.m. And just fingers crossed, hopefully something happens.
Did they eat a lot of donuts up there in Canada at the police station?
Well, this was all in the U.S. They would
so
never
yes, they ate a lot of donuts.
They did. They would never do a show. They wouldn't do a show like that in Canada. First of all.
Wait, why not? What's the difference?
Here's my theory is that even though, so in order to be on TV, if they're arrested, they're caught doing something bad, I need to get their signature as a release form. So
sounds like a fun job.
It was tough at times, you know, and if they were overly intoxicated.
How do you pitch that?
How do you pitch what?
Like you go, hey, I know you're being arrested currently, but if I could just get your old signature right here, we'd like to put your face on TV.
You know what? It was not easy at times, and I had to spend a lot of time doing some convincing. I even had to go to a jail cell and you know, like, give them a story and say, like, hey, I was young, I was dumb, I did the same thing. It's not too bad.
So now I just want to exploit you on television.
Exactly.
Make it your worst nightmare so that everyone can watch you in 4K.
It's going to air once, don't worry about it, type of thing.
That's but
so
crazy.
Here's the thing about Canadians.
Did you ever feel like you were Americans. Like the devil doing that?
I did. I felt bad.
I feel like that's not your character because you're such a nice like person that you're like, here, listen, everything's going to be fine. We're just going to totally make you look like a total absolute idiot on television and then make your stupid crime available to everybody forever and then make it like an infinite thing. So even when you die, your legacy is going to be your stupidity. One time did something stupid at a Dave Matthews concert. Look over here.
Yeah, exactly. Look over here. Yeah, it was a learning experience, you know. I don't regret anything I did, and I never coerced people to the extent where, you know, I forced them. And like I was saying before, if they were overly intoxicated, I would not allow them to sign anything. I would find them the next day because I knew where they lived.
Find them.
I would find them the next day and do my convincing. And I was
like, if you post my bail, I'll consider signing.
Like, what do you show up like looking like when you convince people? Like, do you have like, are you in all black? Do you have like crazy, like, you know, Tom Ford glasses you pull off and you're like Morpheus?
No,
and, like, you're man.
I would be just like them. That was, you know, I would be just like them. And that was my pitch is that we've all sort of been there, done that. The cameras were there. We caught it, you know?
Yeah.
Let's just do this.
What was the reaction to the cameras in general? Because like no one on Cops or on those shows ever like looks at the camera and goes, why is there a camera pointed at me for this like, you know, traffic stop?
So a lot of the time they will do that, but we keep shooting.
Yeah.
You know, we'll edit that part out where, you know, they question the cameras. They say, get away, get away, get away. Mm-hmm. We keep shooting because, again, we cannot use it until they sign. So we keep shooting in the hopes that I could convince them after the fact to sign it if it's a good enough story.
This seems awfully invasive.
It is. It definitely is. But, you know, everything was done in public. We never went to people's houses.
Maybe you shouldn't sell drugs.
Right. Maybe you shouldn't put a pylon on your head and steal from a construction site and walk down the street.
So how long were you doing that show, and what was kind of like the turning point for you to transition into your next project? Like, how did that one kind of end, and how did you move on to the next thing?
Well, as it was said, it was kind of prefaced before. I got into a bit of an accident on that show. So on that show,
and
you know what? Like, this is in all seriousness. It was very tragic. There was somebody died. My cameraman passed away. We always took aerial shots of wherever we were. So, you know, we took a helicopter and did some aerial shots, and things didn't go as planned. Things went wrong and we crashed and I survived.
Oh my God.
What was that like? Like, can you tell us like what it was like when you were up there, you're shooting, and then like, how did you know things were fucking wrong?
You know what? That's something that your brain just like pops out. Like I remember up until the time where you know something's going to go wrong, and then your brain just shuts down until the next thing I remember is I'm on the ground in the weirdest position in like a tremendous amount of pain. And I remember being pulled out by firefighters. And then I woke up the next, in probably a few days later than that.
Oh, wow.
In really bad shape. Pretty much everything from my hip to my shoulder was broken. Spine, pelvis, everything.
Wow.
It was bad.
So what was the cause of that?
So the cause, you know, most likely was just overloading the helicopter and inexperience in a pilot in flying with a cameraman hanging out the side. Because that's typically what we do is like when we shoot stuff.
So wait a minute.
Cameraman
was hanging out the side.
Correct.
Of the helicopter.
Yes.
Which caused too much gravity things, well, inertia,
whatever.
No, but he's hanging out, and when you guys go down, he's outside.
Ben, don't try to explain it. Why don't you let him explain it?
No, I'm trying to envision it.
I know. So typically the way filming works from helicopters, if you don't have like a proper camera mount on the front, is you'll have your cameraman in a seatbelt. We duct tape the seatbelt so they can't pull the lever as a backup. They're out the side filming. And, you know, we hover the helicopter in a certain position and we film statically in a certain position for a while he's out the side. I'm in there telling the pilot and telling the cameraman, okay, we need this element. We need this element. Let's do this. So I think really what it came down to was it was a shitty helicopter. The pilot didn't have the experience he needed for flying with a door open with a cameraman filming. And next thing I know, we're on the ground.
Jeez.
Oh my God. I'm sorry, dude.
Yeah, that's intense.
And who's responsible for that? Like when something like that happens, who the fuck is responsible? Because I would just be beside myself, especially if I find out like it was a bullshit helicopter, or, you know, the guy had, it's a second day on, and meanwhile you're doing like advanced stuff,
right,
and it's your team that's been impacted by this craziness.
Yeah, you know what? There's a lot of blame that goes on, you know, the production company. Why did they hire this guy? I had no say in that. They set it all up. I sort of just walk on and do it. There's pilot error. And again, that helicopter was not designed for doing that type of stuff. So there's just a cascade of bad luck.
Yeah. So,
but good luck for me, because I'm here.
How did you recover after that? So what was the process like? I don't know if that's what you were going to ask, Corey, but
it was a long recovery. And honestly, the thing that saved my life is I've always been big into fitness. So what kept me alive and, you know, what kept me going was my fitness level. What held my back together was my back was super strong and my muscles kept my spine aligned. I was able to rebound pretty quickly. You know, it took a good 6 months.
6 months for like, dude, I literally pull a muscle in my back.
Oh my gosh,
now,
yeah.
And
I'm years.
Gone for 6 months. You literally destroyed half of your body and you're like, yeah, it's fine. Like, dude, you look great. Okay.
I worked hard. I worked hard. I worked super, super hard because
is there anything that's affected like permanently from this, or like, are you fucking just good?
I'm good. I'm like, you know, my back always hurts, yeah, but I just,
well, so is mine.
I deal with that.
Did they give you any like did they tell you that maybe you weren't going to be able to walk or anything like that? Or was it always?
They didn't think I was going to survive the night. Tell you the truth. They told my family, you need to drive from Toronto to Pennsylvania and get here fast because Paul's not going to survive the night. So,
holy shit.
But I did.
Well, we're glad, man.
Wow.
We're glad you're here to talk about it.
What a real miracle, honestly. Like, wow.
Seriously. Yeah.
Do you
really
get workers' comp for that?
And
does someone follow you around and watch your Twitter and make sure that you're not doing anything? They're like, he's well enough to work. He's in like Miami chilling by South Beach, even though you're like a full body cast.
I was freelance at the time, so I really didn't get much. I got government unemployment.
How's that?
Oh my gosh, but
or is it American unemployment?
Same thing. I think it's basically the same thing. It's so long ago, I don't remember what we were getting, but
yeah. with an event like that, in terms of your life, do you view that as a before and after type of thing? Is that like a huge part, or is you know, because of the way you were able to recover quickly, are you able to compartmentalize that as just, you know, a tragic event?
I think that's exactly it. It was like a small chapter of my life that I totally want to put behind me. I have been in a helicopter since. It took me a while to jump back into a helicopter. The first time I got into a helicopter after that was with the military. So I felt totally secure.
Right.
And like,
yeah.
The Canadian military or the US military?
The Canadian military. So I figured if I'm going to jump back into a helicopter, I'm positive. If I'm going to jump back into a
helicopter. Weren't they responsible for the Spruce Goose?
What's the Spruce Goose?
You don't remember that stupid giant fat plane that like got like 60 feet and then like nosedived because it was like so fat in like the 30s?
No.
They made a movie about it.
Really?
Yeah.
Because it was fat.
No, it was a giant plane. It was like the biggest plane they had ever made. And first off, I don't think it's Canadian. I was just being an asshole. But like, no, it was like, it's called the Spruce Goose. It, like, I think it went like 300 feet and then crashed because it was like just too big and it wasn't engineered well.
Would you fly in a plane called the Spruce Goose?
Dude, I wouldn't. I don't want to fly in a plane. I don't even want to be here.
I don't think you want to leave your house, to be honest. So forget even getting on a plane.
I mean, yeah. It's one of those things where it's like I've been on. Well, you know, it's crazy because my grandfather was a pilot. My dad was a pilot, but really? My grandfather actually passed away in a plane crash because he had a small plane and one of the engines blew. And my grandmother and grandfather, you know, passed away. So it's like, yeah, it was weird. But like, I grew up flying, so it didn't bother me. And it was only like one time that I think I remember, like, one guy when I was working at Circuit City in another lifetime, we were flying to like Richmond, Virginia, because that was where the corporate headquarters was. And he was like, "How do you fall asleep?" Like, and then just wake up, and then he's like white knuckling it straight the whole way. And I'm like, I don't know. I just think about how, like, you know, people I know have crashed on planes and then I just fall into oblivion and wake up and I'm there. And that, I think that that's just like a weird way of just like taking the worst feelings and then just making fun of it. But even at the same time, it still like hurts you because you still have to face it. But life goes on. So you have to get back on the plane and you have to get back in the helicopter if that's what you want to fucking do. Exactly. And your perseverance is ridiculous, dude. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that definitely says a lot that you're able to do that. So,
yeah.
And that was a dark way of getting to that, right?
Yeah, it was tough. It was tough on me. It was tough on my family. It was tough to jump back in the saddle again to get back to work after that. But yeah, it's.
So what was, you know, your next move after you, you know, were recovered and feeling, you know, back to yourself?
So from there, I decided to settle down a little bit and get into news, which is sort of segue into where I am now. So in one of our major networks, you know, sort of like a CNN type thing where we, you know, it's 24-hour news channel. I produced a business show and a medical show for that network. And, you know, it's a weekly business show and a weekly medical show. It's pretty low key. Lots of interesting information. And from there, it was on to investigations. So that's where I've been for, I think, about 8 years now.
Wow. So in the business and the medical show, were you directing the content? Like, what was sort of your job description and your involvement on the production?
I was one of the senior producers on that show. So yeah, we would figure out topics to do. We would have, I would find the guests, I would film all the elements. We'd have our main doctor, sort of, you know, the Canadian version of us, Sanjay Gupta, something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, like the national doctor would host the half hour show every week and have two or three topics that, you know, was public interest. So I was in the driver's seat for those shows and business too. I learned to really enjoy teaching business to people who really didn't understand things. You know, I made the show super easy to understand. Like basic stuff, like what is a stock? I did a whole show on that people loved because you'd be surprised. What is a stock?
You know, yeah. Like was that. This? Would
no,
this have been?
I'm not surprised. I'm a guitar player. I'm surprised when people actually like. I talk to people and they're like, "I read this book," and then insert something intelligent here. I'm like, "You did? You can read?"
So. Well, no, I was going to ask, was this in the era of social media? Because now, of course, everyone goes to YouTube to learn everything. So I feel like, you know, doing stuff in TV or radio or whatever, where you're educating people, especially pre that, would have been super cool.
You know what? It was during that time, and the shows got canceled because that's what's happening.
Yeah. Interesting.
Television's being devalued by YouTube.
It's really, we're in a really, really tough spot now. You know, we just had a massive amount of layoffs 2 weeks ago at my company. Just it's hard to make ends meet when people want their content for free.
Yep.
People don't want to pay for
it. It's almost like music, Paul.
Yes. No, absolutely.
It's everything. Everyone wants everything for free.
Right. But I think music's turning a corner. You know, with
finally
music's turning a quarter. I think people are seeing the value in that. People are paying for Spotify. People are paying for Apple Music. in pretty big numbers.
That's good, but remember that they're paying for that, and that's going to someone
one guy.
Most likely someone is not the musician.
Yeah, nobody.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tell me your point of view.
For example, like Allo Black, I think he was streamed 433 million times. I think it's like some crazy, absolutely insane time, like Wake Me Up, the Avicii song, and made like $5,000. That's absolutely insane. So saying like, oh yeah, I support by Spotify. No, they need to figure out better ways to empower artists and all that. And a guy like David Ellison from Megadeth, who we had on our show, has met with like the Grammy committee to try to figure out incentives. But as far as the reason you're seeing a turning in the music industry, I think it's because there's a whole generation of people that are now alive and playing music that have never paid for music. And now they're like, dude, how do you make it? How do you do stuff? Like, what do you do? And they're having to figure out and be entrepreneurial because music has been so devalued that like even giving it away for free is not enough to keep people's bandwidth. So it's a very hard thing. But I mean, I think what it comes down to is that they need to figure out ways to give back the people who are streaming. So all the internet providers need to figure out a way to somehow incentivize the people, the writers, the musicians, all the breakdown sheets that you have based incrementally on what's happening. And it can't be some like pennies on the dollar, like you have 33 million views and that's when you start making like enough money to pay your electric bill. Yeah. Like, and that's literally the insane level of, because I know people who have 100 million views on YouTube who they're not living off of that. If I had 100 million anything, I should be living off of it. So there's a serious breakdown. And you, from the 80s where people were getting paid millions to do records, now they not only expect you to do it yourself, they expect you to like tour yourself and to do pretty much everything. And then they'll just take their cut by giving you distribution when you can distribute yourself anyhow.
Yeah. It's a broken system. And for music, for television, I think for the arts in general, it's a broken system. There's
entertainment in general.
Yeah. There's very little value put on the people who actually make the content.
Yeah. What I think about is funny about the television stuff is we kind of had this nice little period of time when these streaming services started that you thought that, oh, maybe I can like just get, you know, because everyone hates cable. Like, fuck cable. I don't want to pay all this money for channels that I'm not going to watch. So you get, you know, you have Roku, you get Netflix and Amazon, all these cool things. And it was kind of this nice little, oh, this is what it's going to be like. I'm just going to pay for the things I want. And then, you know, all of a sudden now every single network's coming up with their own streaming service. So now people have to decide, oh, I get this month, I'm going to watch my CBS shows. And like, then I'm going to cancel that. And I'm going to go over and get Hulu and watch those shows. And so I think overall between the music, television, entertainment, movies, film, I mean, the movie industry is screwed now that people, they're releasing movies, you know, direct
my
on 15 demand.
Year old literally like had me go to her room and what we streamed movies that were like still in the theater.
Yeah.
So at, like 4K with no interruptions, absolutely beautiful quality. I'm like, are you
theaters
fucking serious?
Are screwed. Theaters are screwed now. So this whole like industry, you know, entertainment is got to, there has to be some sort of equilibrium that we have to find. Otherwise, it's going to change the way that stuff's made.
Where do you guys get your news?
Facebook.
I mostly read like New York Times or Wall Street Journal stuff, like like articles. No, because that's the thing with Facebook or social media, you just get bombarded and it is kind of like a feedback loop. So I try to avoid getting news on social media. But yeah, I mean, I don't really watch TV either, to be honest, for news.
Yeah, it's funny. I have a Google feed that gives me news, but I know that it's curated just to show me what I want to see. But I also, I worked in news radio for a decade and I try to avoid news as much as possible, except for the things that are going to affect me. So like I do kind of self-curate what I see as far as like the things that are important to me. But it's definitely, I mean, if I'm flipping through and I see news on TV, it, for the most part, unless local news, I think is still okay. But any network news, for the most part, is very upsetting. Just seeing some of the bullshit that is out there.
It's totally changed. Like network news. Like I'll say that, you know, the 6 o'clock shows, the 11 o'clock shows that are just giving you the news. Mm-hmm. Those are still incredibly important in our society and need to be supported. But the networks that are opinion driven, That's what they are. It's not news anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, the networks have taken like divisiveness and they're like, okay, we're going to do this and we're going to do that because they have to create chaos. There has to be some sort of discord. And if like, you know, Fox and CNN were agreeing on everything, then they couldn't vilify the other. And that's not good news because you can't keep people engaged.
Yeah, cool.
Do you see a difference between the approach of like American versus Canadian news networks? Because I wonder if a lot of it is just kind of an American thing, because I feel like in other of course it exists, but I feel like there is a big difference between American news and other news stations in other countries.
It is like night and day.
Hmm.
Our news channels are the news. There are some opinion shows, but 99% of the news on our news channels is the news. They're giving you the news without an opinion. Facts, and that's what it is.
Third party omniscient.
There's
yeah, no, that doesn't happen here. I mean, I really don't think it does happen.
It doesn't. And I'm a news junkie. I watch news all the time, all day, all night. it's bad. I it's what I do, it's what I love.
It could have been video games.
But yes, it's, we get every American network. We get Fox, we get CNN, CNBC. They all are skewed in a certain direction and they now cater to their viewer.
Yeah.
It's 100%.
So what would be some of the structural differences in the news stations between the US and Canada, let's say? Because I'm sure obviously, you know, to me, I consider American news TV like entertainment. You know, they're living off advertisers, whatever's going to get the clicks, the watchers, the viewers. So, you know, it's obviously going to be easy to cater to whoever is your highest bidder. Is it different in Canadian news networks? Is like, where's the revenue coming from?
The revenue stream's the same thing. There is some government support for our news. It's all part of, and that's
your government corrupt?
No. Well, every government's corrupt, right?
Well, because there's just a presupposition there.
No. So the reason why I say our government supports a lot of our news is because neighbors to the south, the US, is the media king. You guys produce so much. And if there was no funding for Canadian TV, there's no way we could keep up.
Well, isn't Twitter free?
Mm.
Yes, Twitter's free, but where's the source?
Donald Trump.
Exactly.
No longer.
Exactly. Exactly. So there's, you know, it is basically the same. It's mostly revenue driven by ads with a bit of government support for our newscasts, just because we need it. Yeah. Otherwise we'd be gobbled up.
Yeah.
We would have nothing.
So is there an agency, because it's getting government support, is there an agency that will regulate sort of what the news stations have to adhere to in terms of content and,
so
you know, how it's pitched?
There is an agency, but they have no say in what is said on. They're totally autonomous. They set rules. It's called Canadian content, where you have to have a certain amount of Canadian content on your networks, Canadian produced, Canadian shows. There has to be a certain amount of Canadian content. That's all they say. They will never tell you what needs to go on the news. And you know, even though we get some money from the government, my job is to hold the government accountable. My job is to hold every level of government accountable, industry accountable. When people are doing bad things, I need to make that clear to them that we're watching you.
Interesting.
Does accountable mean the same thing in Canada as it does in the United States?
Yeah, why wouldn't it?
I just have been watching the news sometimes, and that's why it might not.
Yeah,
no one's held accountable here.
Hot take, Ben.
Right,
son.
And you know what? A lot of people aren't held accountable here, but we bring topics to light. So
I had a question. It's gone into the ether at this point. What is it? You mentioned that you that you you have this, your job is to expose people, and like that seems like that's a ingrained attribute of yourself. What about that kind of work and that kind of responsibility? You know, where'd that come from for you?
Good question. So where did that come from? I love the news. But the thing I like about the news and sharing the news is not the 1.5 minute story.
Mm-hmm.
It's the half hour story. It's like really telling my subject story.
So is it like a truth thing? Like more so than like news kind of, it can be this big, you know, oh, the stock market went up today, but is it more like getting to the bottom of a story and
exactly.
And
that's what I do. Yeah. I do long format investigative journalism. So every story I do is 30 minutes or an hour long, where if I have a victim, I'll get into the victim's life. I'll be able to talk about their time before. So another story I'm working on right now is medical errors, like medical malpractice. And the fact that in Canada, it's a lot, we're not a suing culture here. And for victims to get compensation is incredibly difficult, where there's some blatant errors and there's some repeat offender doctors that, you know, probably shouldn't be practicing or probably shouldn't be doing things. So it's holding the system to accountability.
So as someone that's kind of producing the news, do you have to cover a certain range of topics, or where do you get your leads? What does a strategy session look like for that? Just interested to hear. Yeah. Like how you come up with, like, what is the news that we're going to cover? Cause that's such a huge topic. Like you could cover so many different things going on. How do you choose?
Yeah. So for my show specifically, we have a team of, I guess there's about 5 producers, a couple of associate producers that sort of all work together. And we spend a good 3 months researching stories, and we have a pitch session where we take the best of them and, you know, and our executive producers like, go after these stories, go get it. You know, I try and bring these stories up, and the ones I feel strongly about, you know, we're given the freedom to go for it.
Can you give us some examples of like recent stories or stories that were really interesting to you that, you know, some of the longer format? It's just interesting to hear the process.
But let me tell you about the story. I didn't work on it, but I found it incredibly compelling and it's a topic that needs to be dealt with. Last week we had a story on rape kits. So if a woman gets raped, she goes to a hospital and there's a whole forensic examination that happens. And what was discovered in Canada is that 50%, I don't know the exact percentage, but there's a big percentage of hospitals that do not have access to those rape kits.
Wow.
So if a woman goes through a terrible experience like that, sometimes in order for her to get justice, she would have to go to the police. And that's sometimes the last place a traumatized victim would want to go. They would want to be in the comfort of a hospital. They would want to have somebody take care of them, you know, with compassion versus a male police officer. You know, they may not feel comfortable with that. So the story brought to light that not every Canadian hospital has rape kits available. Some very northern remote locations in Canada, they would have to fly the patient somewhere to get a proper forensics done, which in a traumatic, like some victim who's been traumatized, it's not right. So the story brought that to light. So that's an incredibly important story to tell. I didn't work on it, but
yeah,
it was very powerful to me.
When you do stories like that, have you noticed that real change is happening? I'm just always curious, you know, because you see these things on the news and I always wonder, like, you know, what actually happened after that? Like, did people really like think, okay, we got to like change this? Do you follow up on those things to see?
Yeah, sometimes they do. Like sometimes we push for policy change and it happens. You know, hey, if one hospital administrator sees this and says, we're going to get these $80 rape kits and train one nurse to administer that, it's done its job type of thing. Are we able to tell across the country the metrics? No.
Sure.
You know, sometimes our show has been able to push policy change. Money laundering. We did a big story on money laundering in real estate, and that helped drive some change. How, you know, foreign nationals would come in and launder money through our real estate. So
wow.
Why do you have to call me out? So like when I'm just about to make some money, dude, like that was such a good call, man. Washing it in Canada.
Well, yeah.
Washing that was the name of our next record. Washing it in Canada.
There you go. So
it's not as diluted anymore. The actual exchange rate, it's surprisingly in your favor by comparison to how it was when you first came over here.
Slightly, yeah. US dollar is still very powerful.
Maybe more now this month.
Right. But our money's plastic now, so our money will last longer.
Yeah, that's why you should get a Bitcoin.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. Oh, Bitcoin is different world. Yeah, no kidding, right?
So we got about 5 minutes left in this part one. That's, yeah, I think we've covered quite a bit.
Absolutely,
you've got a pretty crazy story.
Yeah, we got a great overview.
In the next part, I would love to learn more about what goes into the investigation side of your job. Mm-hmm. So maybe when we come back there, we can really dive deep, because I think that everyone sees the final product, obviously, mm-hmm. in the nice buttoned up 30 to 60 minute format. But like you said, it's months of, you know, preparation and all this work goes into it. So it'd be cool to learn a little bit about that. But before we go, if we have any viewers and listeners in Canada, where can they, you know, see what you're doing and how can people find you?
So the show is pretty well known. It's called W5, five W's, who, what, when, where, why. And it's on one of our national broadcasters. So every Saturday night, 7 p.m. for 1 hour.
Very cool.
And we're on YouTube. You could search up W5. You can find us on YouTube, and you'll get all the shows we've done for the past 7 to 10 years.
Well, if you had to give one recommendation for people to start on, what would be the good hookiest episode you can think of off the top of your head?
How sticky?
Good question. Let me think about that. Can I tell you on the flip side?
Absolutely. You guys have to come back for part two to hear it.
Yeah.
I think Paul just 2020 you in his own little passive Canadian way. So you're just going to have to stick around for later this week with Paul Haber.
Thank you, as always, for checking out this episode of 2020. Please visit 2020-D.com, like and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on future episodes. This week's throwback clip is from episode number 47, featuring television producer and winner of The Amazing Race, Alex Boylan. Check it out.
Yeah, I mean, I would say travel's pretty much like defined me. It's like at the end of the day, that's like, you know, I think Bert and I, at one point, we went down to the Dominican Republic like a few years ago, first time like just taking a trip for not working, and like we just circumnavigated the thing on just like, let's just him and I go for somewhere, because most of the 99.9% of the time I'm in a location filming, right? And even though amazing that is, it's been a while, maybe a few surf trips here and there, that I actually don't travel all that much for myself, and I'm trying to get back there. And we sat back and one night with tequila, and we were like, let's go through and see. And we filmed in over 68 countries together. Like, it's unbelievable, right? And like, and that was just two kids with like an idea, you know?
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.